So, here comes somebody else. So as I was saying earlier, you know, just I'm sure you're all aware, this is not meant to be an esoteric, only inward practice that we can only do in the refinement of a retreat or silence, but that the effect and the whole motivation really is, as I said, to bring this steady awareness into all aspects of our life, not just as a task that's a nice thing to do, but really to, as I was saying, purify all the habits of our heart and mind. And this, again, it seems like just inner work, but actually it moves very much into the whole realm in our lives of action and relationship. So that's where we're going next, action and relationship. So there's many different ways to talk about this in terms of the teachings. And I'll talk about one, but just to let you know, there's no magic secret. You know, it's like, it's really the sense of various ways of looking or talking about how we choose, what practices we choose to develop, sometimes one more than other, to keep changing these habits of mind, to affect how we think and speak and act in the world until all of our life really becomes part of it. There's nothing left out. So how do we manifest awakening? How does it cultivate in our life? How does this practice affect our actions and our relationships? How does that come into it? So I want to talk about, there's lots of different teachings. But this particular one, I might not get through the whole thing, but it's called Mindfulness and Clear Comprehension. It's in the suttas and then in the commentaries. Sati means mindfulness. Sampajanya, clear comprehension, clearly knowing. It's the discernment, a wisdom aspect. And these two are often put together. Sati Sampajanya, or mindfulness, clear comprehension, you might see it expressed in that way. So even in one of the main most well-known discourses of the Buddha, the Satipatthana Sutta, where a lot of the different techniques of meditation are drawn from mindfulness, that phrase with mindfulness and clear comprehension is used frequently. And clear comprehension is often said as clearly knowing one moves forward, one moves back. Clearly knowing one goes to the bathroom. Clearly knowing. So it's this sense of not only the mindfulness that's just present, but clearly knowing in the larger, more relational circumstance, in the whole arena, you could say. And so they talk about that in a few ways. They all move together. This is, once you start talking about different ways, it's just arbitrary, you know. So if I don't get through all of them, it doesn't matter because they all mix up anyway. But they talk about clear comprehension in four ways of looking at our life. One is clear comprehension of purpose, full awareness of purpose, the motivation of actions, why we're doing things, both smaller purpose and larger. And I'll probably talk mostly about that. The next is of suitability, appropriateness, the sense of flexibility, the sense of we're not just acting in isolation, but always part of a wider situation, always affected and affected by others, other beings and the situation. And then the domain of meditation, the reality, the sense that what is the domain of meditation? Guess what? Everything. Right? How do we use that? So just to say some things about that, all of that. But first to say, it's very clear, how does this affect our actions? Absolutely, our actions are very important. And as how we think, how we understand the world leads to how we act. And the Buddha said very clearly and several times that a wise person is known by their actions. It is through the activities of one's life that one's discernment shines, that one's wisdom shines. So he's never advocating an esoteric isolationist form of spiritual path. Through the activities of one's life that one's discernment shines. And the same thing is for a fool. He says exactly, a fool is known by their actions. You know, through the activities of their life, their foolishness shines anyway. So he's very clear about this, that our understanding, our purification, our waking up, our giving full, wholehearted awareness to whatever's happening now isn't just something to do in isolation. This is going to show up in how we live our lives. But here, the salient and really important point in terms of clear comprehension of purpose is to understand really what is the Buddha referring to by our actions. He's very specific because he says the intention that's arising in the heart mind in a moment, it's a moment of movement that leads to a thought, a speech, an action. So it's a little, chaitana is the word in Pali, it's just a little movement of mind. You know, you wouldn't move your arm without that little movement. You wouldn't decide to come to this retreat without that movement, you know, sign the pen, whatever you do. But the quality in the heart mind at that moment, whether it's of anger, whether it's of compassion, whether it's of wisdom, whether it's of whatever, that is what he calls the seed, the heart of the action, the motivation, the intention. That's really where the ethical quality of the action is, where whether it's wholesome, whether it's unwholesome. And this is, I find, quite profound, and it's really been so like key and helpful to me in my ongoing practice in life to bring awareness to this, to have it pointed out and bring awareness. Because I think generally maybe, without really quite this broad awareness, the tendency is to think an action is, we judge the actions by the results, no? If, you know, you give something and it helps somebody, great, that was really nice. So we say someone's generous, the more they give, the more generous they are, you know, and like that. And it's interesting because the results of action is the one thing, as Sharon Salzberg likes, that's the one thing that's really not in our control at all. We can think it's going to be, but we never know all the circumstances. But the way the Buddha described the karma, the ethical quality of wholesomeness or unwholesomeness of an action is completely in the motivation, in the intention. He says again, the intention is kama, I tell you. Wholesome, unwholesome. Hence the seemingly endless going on about noticing the quality in the mind that's aware. So this is really to tune into, just to begin to explore this for ourselves, or continue to. I'm sure most of you are quite aware of this, that the same outward-looking action could arise from very different motivations. And even sometimes we fool ourselves. Being like Ajahn, I was reading an Ajahn Suchito, and he said, you know, one could say something that seems to be very kind, it's very kind in the words, but actually in your intention, you're filled with malice. You can imagine that, no? Or you say something, you want to be helpful to somebody, but it's something that might be a little difficult for them to hear. You could say it really out of kindness and care. You could mean to say it out of kindness and care, but your exasperation takes over just when it's coming out of your mouth, and you know. Or you could say it with kindness and care, but you're completely oblivious to the time that you pick or the circumstances that person's in. And they come home and they've just gotten home from work and they're completely blasted and exhausted. And you go, I really want to tell you this thing for your own good. You know, everybody hates it when you do X, Y, and Z. He's like, thank you very much. So kind of you, you know. And so it's like not really an aversive thing, but a confused, deluded thing, just not looking at the whole picture. And so where this sati sampajanya, mindfulness, clear comprehension of purpose, begins, and this is where our steady awareness practice is so profound, really, is we just more and more are beginning to notice what's the quality in the mind that's motivating this action. Not every time you blink your eyes, don't make yourself crazy, but we can really notice. Bringing mindfulness, this steady awareness, again, not with judgment, not it should be a kind action, then we can't see what's really going on. We want it to be kind. Maybe it isn't, but we can't really see. But if we're using this quality of steady, non-judging, receptive awareness, we start to see. And we're looking with interest, not with a should. It does get really interesting. And we start to actually see little actions that aren't bad, but just coming from restlessness or coming from boredom. And watching the whole show, you start to, the clarity, the clear comprehension of the whole situation just starts to show up. An example, I think I gave this last week. I really know just simple things. I'd get in the car to drive when I was first exploring this. Get in the car to go somewhere, and it would just automatically, my hand would go out to turn on the radio. That's not bad or wrong. Nothing wrong with that. But just as I became, you're just mindful of what you're doing, just noticing that, and then starting to notice what was the motivation, just feeling what was going on in the heart mind. And it could be different things. It could be there was a particular time of day and a program I wanted to listen to. Rare, but it could be. But often it was just like, just a habit, turn it on, just a kind of a restlessness, a boredom, you know. Okay, so you just turn it on driving and it recognized in 3 minutes, this is actually agitating, this is actually irritating, so I turn it off, fine. And 2 minutes later, my hand's going out again to turn, what's this about, you know, just restlessness, agitation, I turn it on, then you start changing the channels, you know, and then you practically drive off the road changing the channels, and it's really... Every time I would chant, I could see it's wanting. Not this one, let's try this one, not this one, let's try this one, you know, like channel surfing on the TV. And if you don't make it bad or wrong, but just let the steady awareness watch that, the sense of wanting, feeding wanting, and leaning into the next thing and the dissatisfaction, it gets so obvious. You kind of go, wow, how could I miss this? Let me just turn it off. Ah, peace. Driving along. There's the reservoir. It's so beautiful. And the next thing you know, the hand's going out to turn on the radio. So just watching this with mindfulness, with awareness, and just seeing it, it really, the habit starts to change because the dissatisfaction of that whole thing is so obvious. You don't have to beat yourself up. It's clear. This sati sampajanya, truth discerning wisdom, is how Ajahn Buddhadasa would translate that. Truth discerning wisdom, just the steadiness discerns the truth of, oh, it's feeding wanting, it's agitating, it's unpleasant. Just be here and drive. That sense of just being present with things as they are is so much, I don't know what word you work for you. For me, it's kind of complete, present, peaceful. Just this. But no, maybe I should turn it's like, oh my God. So exploring, that's on a very simple level. But this works on a much, much more profound level, where even when we have something very important, an action that we want to do, really our attention keeps noticing the seed of it is in our heart, our mind, in a moment. This is from Martin Luther King. Nonviolence means avoiding not only external physical violence, but also internal violence of the spirit. You not only refuse to shoot a person, you refuse to hate them. And if you've, read it all about a King, Gandhi, Jim Lawson, how they all work with nonviolence as an act of an action in the world, they're so clear that nonviolent action, the seed, the heart of it, is in the heart. You know, so even if you're out doing nonviolent action, but filled with anger, filled with hatred, that's not nonviolent action, in the way that they talk about it. And that is really how the Buddha is describing. So this is where we explore. And we can't just, okay, now, from now on, as an act of will, I'm deciding to give up aversion as a motivation for action. You know, that's not possible. Would that it were. So don't think you should be able to. And then start noticing the motivations and get down on yourself. That's the whole thrust of this practice I've been sharing this weekend, is just with steady awareness, see how the mind is working without judgment, without trying to make it match some ideal you don't even know what it is or how to get there. But with the steady awareness, we start to see, like my simple little example, how the wanting works, what the effect is, and with the steady awareness of seeing the effect, oh, need this. A wisdom puts the wanting down. If I decide I'm going to get in a car and never want again to turn on the radio, it doesn't work. I could decide out of willpower I won't turn it on and sit on my hand or something. You can do that. If you're aware of that, that kind of renunciation might also be another way that awareness starts to, wisdom starts to put down the wanting. But again, it's still requiring constant attention. So this sense of the heart of action in the intention is the first step of this clear comprehension of purpose. So just starting and continuing to include that in big things, in little things. Not, as I said, not every time you have a banana, not making yourself crazy, but it is interesting just to watch little choices our mind makes and what's the energy in the heart mind that's making them. Ajahn Buddhadasa says, if you really look, how much of the things we choose are in pursuit of pleasant experience, pleasant feeling tone. He says, maybe 95%. Check it out. Not saying that's bad, but it's good to know. This is where the sampajanya, the wisdom, comes in, knowing why we're doing what we're doing, and then continuing to be aware and noticing the effect. This is where, and this is what's beautiful about the way the Dhamma works, there really is a natural transformation of these habits, of these suffering habits of mind. Like that little example, but really with wanting and the clear seeing and the wisdom, a sense of renouncing, putting down the wanting comes in, a sense of peace. If there's something one could give, then generosity naturally starts to arise more frequently. Not always, but more frequently. Same with ill will towards ourselves or another. The more there's awareness, the steady awareness and wisdom coming in and seeing, it does naturally begin to transform, so that friendliness, metta, loving kindness, arises more frequently. Ill will become not the only go-to motivation when we're not aware. Sometimes it'll surprise us. Oh, a moment of loving kindness. Who was that? You know? But it really does to transform naturally. And cruelty transforms to compassion. Or the cruelty, or the resistance to the unpleasant, which can lead to cruelty, but even just that aversion, it transforms through the steady awareness that lets us just be with the unpleasant when it's happening. Let it go when it goes, but just to be there without resistance, without that habit of resistance. This ability to just be present, with wholehearted presence, with difficult situation, is how compassion arises. Because compassion is really the totality of heart and mind, the friendliness of metta, coming face to face, meeting painful, difficult experience. And when that totality of heart and mind can just be present, this is really difficult. The natural response of the heart mind that isn't clouded by or obscured by aversion, the natural response is compassion. Is friendliness. Sure, there's lots of ways to cultivate it as well, which I'm not talking about here because there's so many, but it also to recognize that just through the steady awareness and wisdom coming, that wholesome, the beautiful qualities are naturally cultivated. It's one of the nice ways that nature works. So that's a clear comprehension of purpose, just being able and interested enough to notice on a kind of moment-to-moment level. But there's a larger way in the commentaries that talks about clear comprehension of purpose in the wider field of the actions of our life, not just this one particular action. So purpose could be, you know, in English we use motivation, intention, as I was just using it just in a momentary way. But don't we also use it in a larger way? What is your motivation for coming here this weekend? You know, not just a moment of greed, say, but a larger purpose. What is your motivation for, you know, having a family? I mean, big things, you know. So this sense of purpose or aspiration, having, and this I've found, again, this has been very, very supportive and, I'd say, onward leading for me in for years and years in my life, in my practice. This sense of, it has to be true for you, tuning into yourself and getting a sense, it's not just something you do kind of off the cuff, but on a deep sense of what really is important to you in your life. Like I was saying this in one retreat, like the sense of purpose and something. Well, I don't, you have to have like this really deep purpose. I don't feel like I have a deep purpose. I'm saying no, you know, it's whatever's true for you. You know, your purpose, this sense of aspiration might be you really want to take care of your family. You know, it might be that you really want to cultivate a loving relationship with your partner. Whatever the heck that means, we don't know how it's going to turn out, but it might be, it doesn't have to be, my purpose is to become a bodhisattva and become the next Buddha in the next eon. That could be, it could be. It could be that one's purpose is really to cultivate the qualities of heart and mind to really purify from all the habits of greed, hatred, confusion, and actually become a bodhisattva to free all beings. It could be anything. And it's not what it, not thinking what it should be or what looks good or what you think you should be. You really gotta be honest with yourself for this to be useful. And sometimes it just springs up, but whatever it is, when you get a sense of what that is, really, in a way, honor it, I would say. So sometimes one would come up, like years ago, came up, I really want to serve the Dhamma. I had no clue what that meant. And you don't. It's not, we don't know what arc. How can we know what arc our life is going to take, you know? Even if we plan it all out, we don't know. It just goes away like that. And things like if I look at my life, even 5 years ago, I couldn't have planned out or imagined things as they are now, you know? It just, or back when 20 years ago, forget it, just no clue. So things come up. So when that came up a long time ago, the habit, self-denigrating mind went through negativity and who do you think you are and come off it and what does that mean and blah, blah, blah. Don't listen to that. That's just habit mind, you know, whether it's negative or positive. Yeah, you're really great. You're good. Whatever, that, don't listen, that doesn't matter. But the sense of what your purpose is, I really want to be able to be compassionate and loving to my family as much as I can. I want to cultivate that for the rest of my life. That could be a very profound purpose for one. You know, because you kind of just feel it. It's not just like an intellectual thing, you know. You just go, okay, that's important. So whatever it is, if this is meaningful for you. And then the way that Nyanaponika Thera, who was a German Theravada monk in Sri Lanka, who translated a lot of, maybe a generation or so ago, translated a lot of Pali texts into English. He was a teacher of Bhikkhu Bodhi. So he's the one who's I'm using in this. He talks about then using this, having for yourself what this sense of purpose is, can be really supportive when we're making decisions as a way of not just kind of going through life randomly. So even when we're paying attention, we're aware of the moment-to-moment intentions. I mean, I don't want to act from aversion if I have the choice. It could come from kindness or at least hold off. That's good. But it still can be a sense of just kind of reacting to circumstances, maybe in a wholesome way, but, you know, just whatever comes up, I react. That can be fine. But when there is something that's really important to us in our life, and we can connect to it and bring it up, it can, that sense of what's important can become like a guideline, like a beacon in making some of our larger decisions. So instead of just going for what feels comfortable now or this seems like a good thing, say it's taking care of your kids. you know, and I'm assuming this is done with love, that there are many, many, many decisions every day that are taken that aren't what you would particularly want, that maybe aren't comfortable, or that maybe you say things to the kid that aren't what they would want to hear, but you're thinking in the bigger picture of what's going to help them learn, what's going to keep them safe. And you get a sense that it's in service of a larger purpose. It may be an uncomfortable decision now, but it's taken out of love and a sense of, you know, turning our life in that particular direction. And so, of course, since I'm talking in terms of our spiritual practice here, having that in one's spiritual practice is so supportive because we find we can really do things or stay aligned with things that we wouldn't have thought possible from ourselves when you're just kind of drifting through life, you know? And you can't imagine it ahead of time. But I'll give you examples. Tuning in like this, it's really like sports, big sports figures, they do this all the time. I was reading some tennis guy in The Last Generation. Everything he did, if he went to the beach for half an hour, he had to think of how that would affect what he ate and how much time could he spend with his family and when could he sleep. It was all around, you know, being able to go play the tennis match. That might not be the most noble purpose in terms of spirituality, but it's a sense of that's so important that when you're doing something, it's not just random. It's in relationship to that. So in terms of what we can do as a practice, even just sitting and walking all day, if you're new to this, or even if you're not, when we're all by ourselves at home, how easy is it to sit for 45 minutes, walk for half an hour, sit for 45 minutes, walk for half an hour, just all by yourself at home with nobody watching? Not so easy. It's possible, but it's not as easy. But here, you know, you've done it. So sure, the conditions are such that people are supporting you, but you've done it in service of something larger than just feeling pleasant for the moment. So in terms of example, I want to talk about a Chinese Chan monk who died a few years ago, Master Sheng Yan. I had the good fortune to sit a couple of retreats with him. He was really such a wonderful being. He's a very profound monk. And in Taiwan, where he lived, he had a huge monastery center, like 10,000 people there, you know, huge. And he was also very kind, very relational, very connected. I sat with him in Switzerland. With, you know, he didn't know me from anybody. And we didn't even know when we invited him that he was so huge in Taiwan. He was kind of like the Dalai Lama of Taiwan. We had no clue, you know. Oh, he's a nice guy. Let's invite him, you know. And they send a whole camera crew from the Taiwanese main TV station to just film everything. And we're like, what is this about? So he was a big cheese, you know. And he knew who we all were. I next met him like almost a year later at a different retreat center, and he remembered who I was. Based on nothing. I mean, I had just sat in the retreat. I hadn't been part of the organized. Amazing. So relational and kind. So his story is he grew up in the 1920s, 30s in mainland China. Very, very poor, very poverty stricken. And he became a monk in that Chan Buddhist tradition at quite a young age. And it was a really tough life, you know, physically tough, hungry a lot. And then all the wars started in the 20s and the 30s. There was civil war all through China. Then World War II came in. And then the civil war really hotted up. And in 1949, when the communists and Mao was about to take over, it was very clear to him that basically monks weren't going to be allowed to be monks and monasteries were going to be destroyed. And the only way he could get out was to get to Taiwan. He had no money. He never had anything. Was to join Chiang Kai-shek's army, and they would take him to Taiwan. So he did that, and they took him to Taiwan. Well, you didn't just join the army, get a ride to Taiwan, and say, thank you very much, I'm going back to being a monk. And he said, in fact, there wasn't a way to get out of that army. And he said, but in my heart, in my mind, I was always a monk. And he was in the army, I think it was, you know, around about 10 years. And for some reason, this is the karma, he had to do what he had to do in the Army, but he managed to get work. I think it was patrolling the beaches. I don't remember exactly, but he didn't actually have to go into battle. He didn't have to use a gun to shoot people, you know. So that was one thing. Somehow the Dharma takes care of you sometimes. But part of his monk vows in that particular lineage was to be vegetarian. Well, the food wasn't vegetarian. And it wasn't like a sumptuous banquet, right? This is like in civil war. So he would go as long as he could without eating any meat until he'd really be on the brink of starvation. Because I'm a monk, and in my heart I'm always a monk. But he wasn't completely, you know, you'd look at the whole picture, and when he really had to eat meat, he'd eat meat to sustain life. And whenever he had time off, he'd do his practices. He managed over the years to have like a day off and go found a couple of teachers, you know, other monk teachers on the island. And I forget how, it was some complicated way, but it was extremely unusual that after 10 years, with the help of one of the teachers, he managed to get out of the Army. Because I meant 10 years. In my heart, I was always a monk. And then immediately he went into 7 years of solitary retreat under the guidance of his teacher. And he really became this amazing monk practitioner and beautiful person. You never know, you know, where the decision's going to lead. So in a way, what we really can have faith in, sadha, confidence, is when we're aware is, as best we can tell, the purity of our motivation, right? We're not always going to know, and motivation's mixed. And if we have a sense of what's important, that can just help us keep aligning, but noticing it always starts from the motivation, not from the outward looking. He actually, I'm just remembering now in his life afterwards, he always did many, many prostrations, you know, full prostrations, and he felt that's a form of purification of all his past unwholesome deeds, referring to his time in the Army and all the things that he did have to do, even though he wasn't having to kill. So he's always doing prostrations and purifying out of love, not out of aversion, out of wholesomeness, out of beauty. So these, you know, he probably just was like a normal guy. Nobody thought he was any big, you know, fancy monk or anything. So we never know for ourselves. It's a way, it's like not sell ourselves short, but really see. As someone said, in every moment of activity, we're committing to something. The question is, what? It's not a judgment. It's just looking and seeing, starting to see. What's driving our behavior and what's really important and what's the effect of what we do? And it really leads us a great strength and clarity of purpose. And then sometimes we lose it. Of course we're going to lose it, you know. That's fine. But just to, again, oh yeah, right, this is what's really important. You can feel, I mean, I can feel kind of the sense of the energy collecting and gathering and being a bit more directed and upheld when I'm in alignment with what's really important to me. Because we never know how things will turn out, how the situation will be, what will come next. We only have our sincere motivation. As the Dalai Lama used to say that a lot. He must, you know, I have to trust my sincere motivation. Because he can't control what's going on in China, in Tibet. You know, but he has to trust his sincere motivation. So I was saying last week some young Tibetans were once really quizzing him and challenging him and saying, you know, basically, old man, your compassionate, non-violent thing, it's not working, you know. The Chinese government's taking over Tibet and destroying our culture. And according to this article, right, he was, you know, crying, he was weeping, because that's true. And he's saying, yeah, that you may be right. So not trying to be attached to a view, you know. Now I'm the Dalai Lama, don't tell me. He wouldn't say, yeah, you may be right. He was tears. But I cannot do otherwise. I cannot be otherwise. Like his commitment to compassion so strong. And that's really to me a very, same with Martin Luther King, the commitment to nonviolence in one's heart is so strong that you can't try to achieve what you want externally in some other way. That's the violence. That's what rips apart the real freedom of heart and mind, of non-clinging. But this is tough. This is Gandhi. Living a nonviolent life is no easy task. It is not simply pacifism. It requires courageous love drawn from the very source of our being. Nonviolence is not a garment to be put on and off at will. Its seat is in the heart, and it is inseparable. It's an inseparable part of our very being. If one does not practice nonviolence in one's personal relations with others and hopes to use it in bigger affairs, one is vastly mistaken. Practicing loving presence must become our entire way of life, or it seldom works as an occasional tactic. So this is Gandhi speaking, and both these guys, Martin Luther King and Gandhi, having huge effects, but at the same time can't fix the racism. But Gandhi couldn't stop all the violence that went on in the partition, and yet still having huge effects, you know. So this is really the power of our sincere intention and our goal, our purpose really, not goal. It gives such a strength and clarity to our life. And you could say sometimes it makes things more difficult because we can go, oh yeah, let's just do that, it'll be easier, I'll get what I want. We keep looking, what's really important? Okay, I'll skip that story. Too many stories. Okay, so with this sense of this next part, the suitability, the sense of awareness, not just in the narrow focus, and even here, as we've been walking and sitting here, I say a wider focus, but we're still pretty much just with our own experience. But the suitability is wise discernment, clearly knowing. Sometimes the awareness is, you know, just in what you're doing personally. Sometimes it's in the wider situation. Knowing and really being tuned into the fact that we're always part of a wider situation. And that what is appropriate or suitable for waking up for awareness in one situation may not be suitable in another situation. So this is why we can't just have a view of this is what right practice looks like. Why sometimes being with the breath is helpful and sometimes it's not. You can't just make up a list. That's why we never say this is right and this is wrong. If you notice, there's never a sense of this is always the way you do it, because the situation is always changing, internally, externally. So the Buddha recognized this in one way, in when he, various times when he was talking about wise speech. And he said unequivocally to always be truthful. Basically talking to his son, it's never, based in our language, never okay to say an untruth for any reason whatsoever. So there was no equivocation about that in terms of wise speech. But you never tell an untruth. But he's not saying you have to say exactly what's true every single moment. You know that idea? Boy, you know, you look awful today, but that's the truth. I have to say it, you know. he's really saying it's like truthful and useful. And what's useful is also at the right time. So that's taking in the whole situation. This may be true, but is it useful to this person? Is it useful in this particular situation? Even if it's hard to hear, it may be useful if it's at the right time. So he would sometimes admonish the monks or the nuns, you know, correcting them, you know, but try it in a loving way, but feel that that's useful, but also at a time that they could hear it. Like the example I gave earlier, the person's like exhausted and you come, now's my time to admonish you, out of all the day I'm picking this moment. Not useful, not the right time. Oh, we're going to blow it sometime, sure. But you get a sense, this sense of the awareness of the bigger picture requires a flexibility, a sense of awareness of the conditions right in this moment. We can't just get a list of this is what I do and I'm always going to do it this way. Every moment's new and fresh. I love this. in terms of skillful means, you know, what one day, just in terms of meditation practice, what one time is really helpful. I'm tired, I'm sleepy, I need to just do some walking, and the walking helps to refresh the awareness. Great. And then we think, okay, if you're on a retreat or this time every day, I'll take a walk because it refreshes me. You know, you see, we're assuming permanence right there. The next day at that time is a completely, the weather's different, your whole energy system's different, whatever went on in the day is different, your mood is different, and when you take a walk, the effect will be different. And so this sense of suitability is like really looking and seeing and learning what conditions support awakening, and you get the sense of the wider conditions. This is how we learn skillful means. Skillful means is the motivation. So you do the same thing. I take a walk. The next day, the motivation is, let me out of here. I'm taking a walk. And so the whole thing is different. It looks the same. The motivation before was skillful means to wake up. The motivation today is, let's just get away and have some pleasant experience. And you keep paying attention. Keep paying attention. And you may notice maybe you get more pleasant experience, and then you want more pleasant experience, and then you get in your car and you go out and have a pizza, and then you feel kind of sick, so you get in the car and go do something. Maybe I take a nap, and it just goes on and on and on and on. Yeah, I'm exaggerating, but we just start to see. So they're always changing. And the other aspect is, again, as I say, we can't control the effects, the results of our action, but we bring awareness. We say something to someone, we do something that we think is kind, we think is going to be helpful. We don't just say, well, I did the best I can, cello, I'm gone. We notice, what's the impact, you know? So in the beginning, we don't know the impact. We're saying something we think is helpful, and it really hurts someone. It triggers an old trauma. And we can say, oh, okay, the motivation actually was kindness. The impact was difficult for that person in a way that wasn't useful. So then that becomes a piece of clearly knowing the wider situation. And the next time with that same person, if you say the same thing with that same wanting to be kindness and ignoring the fact that you've learned something new, then it isn't so kind because there's delusion in there or not caring. Well, I'm doing kind. I can't help it if you have this trauma, you know. So we learn, we widen, and the situation always changing. It's really so alive. So, and seeing that how much we affect one another, that we all affect one another. We can't act in isolation, much as we might like to. And even when we don't recognize it, just to see we're not separate. We're not separate from nature. Someone was saying the other day, I know I just should be aware, but I feel so happy when the sun comes out, as if that were a problem. I said, right. It's interesting. We often feel happy when the sun comes out. Just noticing that, we're not really separate. I mean, we are nature. Now, if I was in Thailand in the hot season, which I had been, I wasn't so happy when the sun came out. You know, I was sitting there in a little kuti with a tin roof and these long sleeves and the sun's coming out, that red ball of sun coming up, and you're like, oh God, I'll never make it through the day. Different conditions, but we're not separate. And we affect one another so much. And this is something we can tune in and see, you know, that we can really use that to cultivate wholesome in ourselves, but recognize wholesomeness is contagious. You know, who we are, when we're coming from kindness, from integrity, from generosity, it doesn't mean everybody bows down, oh, you're so kind and generous, but it is contagious to the wholesome mind. Just as fear is contagious. You know, if you've ever been around a fearful situation and people are afraid, it kind of ramps it up. But recognizing as part, and this isn't an ego thing, that when you really are becoming more kind, less aversive, or arises more, that affects the people you're with. And we can consciously do this. My friend Sylvia Boorstein, maybe many of you have heard of her. You know, she teaches in the Bay Area. And she told this story one time. She was at some kind of it was like an awards luncheon or something. I don't know what exactly it was. But a lot of people, and you're sitting at a table with just a few other people who you don't know. So she's at the table. She's, talking is easy for her. Let's put it that way. And And she's very wise. I mean, she's not just saying junk. She says a lot of wise stuff. She's very, very friendly. But anyway, so she's at this table, and everyone's talking. She didn't know. And she just started to notice that basically everyone, the other people were like in this really critical mood. They were kind of dissing people, putting people down, talking about other people in a not such a nice way, or I don't know what exactly the content. But she just started to notice this. And she's thinking, well, this isn't wise speech. Thinking. So you don't say, hey, folks, this isn't wise speech. Let's clean it up. No, she didn't do that. But she just recognized, okay, let me come from wholesomeness. And being Sylvia, she just started saying things, kind of, you know, in the conversation in an upbeat way. So maybe she said, you know, this egg salad is really tasty. Just little stuff. But, you know, in a wholesome, friendly way. Or, oh, you know, I really like the decorations. Or maybe she was like not criticizing. Or if someone dissed someone, she didn't go, no, I really like them. It wasn't like antagonistic, kind of coming in from another angle. But basically, she was cultivating wholesomeness. She was cultivating kindness. And she said, in not very long, the whole tenor of the conversation changed. Without her doing anything other than introducing wholesomeness, and people recognized it. And I tried it a couple of times, actually with friends, where we could fall into the habit of, you know, kind of, that person, I don't really like how they do it. And I was with quite a wise friend one time. I mean, I can get into it as much as anyone. But this particular time I remember, after hearing Sylvia's story, I was actually noticed that I was feeling really uncomfortable with the conversation. And if you can feel uncomfortable without it being a negative judgment, not aversion, but just kind of, oh, you know, this just doesn't feel good. You know, we can feel the negativity. And so I remembered Sylvia's thing, and I did exactly that. I didn't say, no, you're wrong, they're really good. But I just, you know, said something kind of obliquely wholesome about that person or someone else. And because this was a very wise friend, I had to say one thing, and she totally got it and stopped. Just like that, you know. This is like another, you know, another practitioner. But this is to see how connected we all are, that we affect and are affected by one another. And so really, not only do other people's wholesomeness inspire us, you know, that's what often gets us into a spiritual path. We're inspired by somebody's goodness or generosity or whatever it is. But recognizing when your body, mind, and don't take it personal, just like we don't take the greed personal, also don't take the generosity, the loving kindness personal. I am the most generous person you're ever going to meet. Isn't exactly the same as, wow, let me just help you right now. So recognizing, though, when you're coming from wholesome, it affects the people around you. It really to see that. Is again a movement into the non-separation aspect of life, that we're part of all of life. And as wisdom starts to become, to see how things actually are through steady awareness, we can't help but notice that. That's why I think came up in the little group today, the Buddha often talked about, you know, if you can't be with wise people, better to wander alone like the rhinoceros horn. That's actually what it says, wander alone like the rhinoceros horn. He's not saying, well, maybe he is, but we're not saying, okay, if you think, you know, your family gets on your nerves, better to wander alone like a rhinoceros, I'm cutting you out, you know, unless it's really damaging. That's a different story. But to recognize the power of Kalyanamitta, wise friends, skillful friends, and to recognize that often you're the Kalyanamitta, the wise friend to others. And it can go back and forth, that this is how the importance of Sangha to really support us all on the path. And it's part of this clearly knowing the effect of the wider situation and that we all are affected and strengthened by each other. And fear and aversion and anger is also contagious, as we see all too clearly in this world. So our actions are really important. Tuning into them, really important. And just trusting that with steady awareness, we see how things really are. You don't have to imagine it. But the situation for each of us in the same situation, the response that we might take even from wholesomeness could be different depending on our conditions, on our personality. So it's also why even though we affect one another and we all support one another, we can't really compare ourselves with each other and try to model, well, that's what he's doing, so that's the right thing to do, that's what I should do. We don't know. This is where clearly knowing and mindfulness of what's really going on in this heart-mind stream, what's really supporting, this is the domain of meditation in our whole life, what's really supporting right now to brighten the heart and mind, to refresh the awareness, to cultivate the wholesome, like what Sylvia was seeing with, what would help me in this moment to move from getting lost in aversion to just opening up to the wholesome. What else? So sometimes awareness isn't quite available, but cultivating generosity. It's a powerful and beautiful practice. Just that willingness to be present for a friend in need, just to listen and let yourself feel the wholesomeness of that action, the happiness of that action. It brightens the heart. It brightens the mind, allows it to turn towards the Dhamma. Same with our non-harming conduct. And recognizing that, say the thought comes up, I could take this, nobody will know, and nobody will miss it. And then you say, oh no, that's stealing, I don't want to do it. But at least for me, the tendency could then be to focus on, oh gosh, you're so bad, you know, you wanted to steal that thing, and you're just, and go on into the negative. But also you could recognize refraining from a harmful action is a wholesome action. Recognizing you're about to say something unkind and refraining from it consciously is an act of non-ill will. It's an act of non-greed. Appreciate that. Appreciating the wholesome actually strengthens our awareness. It strengthens our motivation. It strengthens the wholesome. And the Buddha often talks about this. It's a sense of wise contemplation. Really tuning into wholesome action. Well, okay, so maybe I'm generous, but that other person was more generous. It doesn't make any sense. It's really just tuning in your own heart and mind and seeing what really helps. And sometimes it could be a really an odd way. What means is going to help me come back into awareness? Just being willing to be flexible, open, creative. So the story of Utejaniya, who did a lot of, he's a monk now, he did a lot of his practice as a layman. He suffered from severe depression off and on, and he'd practice often with his monk teacher and had strong concentration. He'd be a monk for a year or so. Then he'd go back out home and get caught up in his bad ways. He was the bad boy of the family. I think he's like eight brothers. They're all doctors, you know, and he was home addicted to cough syrup or whatever. In Burma, and had to work in his father's garment stall in the wholesale market, which he hated. But anyway, at some point, so he knew about meditation, and he'd get all pure in the meditation center, and then, you know, come home and fall apart. So he had this severe depression. He knew about mindfulness, and at one point, he said he saw really clearly that when his attention was just for a moment, really with feeling the breath, for example. At that moment, the mind wasn't depressed. The moment that just pure mindfulness, the mind was going straight. But that was hard to do, so he got one of these inhalers, you know, that you stick in your nose and it gives you this burst of intensity. So he got one of those because when he sniffed it, it was so strong that he'd be aware of the breath. And so that would cultivate mindfulness. So then he just took to just keeping it stuck in his nose. He still does that sometimes. But he'd be like sitting there in the garment thing with this thing stuck in his nose and really mindful with the breath, you know, just feeling the breath and seeing how that moment of mindfulness was a moment of non-depression. And that's where it starts. We start where we are, not how we think it should look or how it should be. His motivation really clear, you know, to wake up. And so that's just a simple example. It's a silly example, but it just shows any way that brings in the wholesome, that brings in awareness. Okay, just a couple more little stories. The sense of realizing that the we could have the same seeming purpose, but how it shows up in life could be different for everybody. We just don't know how it's going to manifest. So maybe some of you have seen, it was like a little hour video of, you know, Sonyi Rinpoche, the Tibetan teacher. Well, anyway, he's a Tibetan teacher. And he's been supporting some nunneries in Tibet called the Nangchen Nunneries. The story of them is that there were quite a few nunneries, maybe 40 nunneries. And during the Cultural Revolution in China, which is about 1975 or so, really whatever nunneries, monasteries were left were destroyed. So they came and destroyed these nunneries. And all these nuns, they were faced with how were they going to respond? How are they going to live their lives? And it was all different. So this movie is about Sungni's going back with some lazy Western supporters to these nunneries because now they're allowed to start to rebuild. So they're seeing what happened to all these nuns over the years. And some of them just went back to their nomad families, picked up their lay clothes, and they lived their life sort of like Master Shen Yin, you know, secret nuns, but living their life and just in their nomad families. Some, for whatever reason, ended up in labor camps, maybe died there. Some went off deep into caves and just lived in isolation and really probably barely survived, you know, barely had enough to eat to survive and live those years, and some died. But then when Sony came back, when they were allowed to start rebuilding, the ones who were alive, they came back from their distant cave, they came back from their nomadic families, they were released from the labor camps, and they all started coming back again together and rebuilding the nunneries, which in Tibet entailed dragging humongous rocks up, you know, 10,000 feet of mountain. I mean, but anyway, so just to see, they all had their sincerity, their purity of purpose. It manifests in different ways. We don't know. So not looking at the externals, but the situation matters. But it starts from in here. It starts from in here. Nisargadatta Maharaj said, when we realize that we are the world is ourself, we become free from greed and fear on the one hand, and the senseless sorrows of humankind become our sole concern. One of those little nuns in the video, they went up, they saved it for them, they went way, way, she was way, way up at the top, living in just this like little box, like she was really old, really old. I mean, she looked like she was about 120. I don't know how old she was. She couldn't get up. All she did was just lie there all day spinning her prayer wheel, you know, as long as she was awake every day. And she said, smiling, of course, beaming, one of these stories of just beaming eyes and saying, I just lie here all day and I just send out wishes. May all beings everywhere be happy and free from suffering. That's what I do all day. You're like, wow, you know, wow. And just one other story like that to end. The same, I think this, to me, could be the effect, the result of a life well lived. It's not so much what he did, it's Mahagosananda, who maybe, you know, he was a Cambodian monk who, after the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia destroyed again most of the monks, killed basically genocide of their own people, including most of his family members. He happened to be outside of Cambodia at the time. So he was a peace activist, a real metta teaching monk, and he would go into the refugee camps where everyone in Thailand was living just beyond devastated. And he would go, and most of the people had been, Buddhism had been their kind of faith. And he would go and just start chanting from the Dhammapada, you know, hatred never overcomes hatred, only by love alone does hatred cease. Can you imagine? But he's saying it not as a, this is what you should do. He's saying it because this is what I know is true. And, you know, just the people just kind of flocking to him. You know, he would, anyway, it's a long story, but that's not the one I want to tell. That's just who he was. A few years, I don't know, maybe it was 10 years ago, I'm not sure. There was a big teacher meeting, Vipassana Tibetan at Spirit Rock. Maybe 100 some odd different teachers from different traditions. Somehow they even had the Dalai Lama there for a day. I'm not sure how they pulled that one off. And Mahagosananda was there. And it's one of these big, you know, in the big meditation hall and different things going on, but we're all in the hall together. So Mahagosananda was there. But he was clearly had dementia at this point. So someone was always with him, you know, just kind of helping him sit. And you know how if you've been with people you love with dementia, you can tell how it just somehow, it's a little bit of a disheveled look. Just the robe wasn't on quite right. The cap's a little pulled. You can just tell just by looking. But anyway, he was just there doing his thing. And, you know, he'd sit there and they'd bring him around to meals and all. Just very sweet. Didn't really say anything. But at the very end ceremony, they asked him to come up on the dais and just share the refuges and precepts and some metta phrase. So he got up, starts off, I think in French he started off. Then he switched to Cambodian, and then something hit the English switch, and he went into English. So this just came rolling out. This is what he knew, right? And that was lovely, and wholeheartedly, not just, oh yeah, maybe, but really wholeheartedly, his whole being. And then they were ending by, you know, sometimes they pass out these little red threads that you tie around your wrist. So they gave them all to him, and all 100 of us, one by one, we would go up to him and receive this thread. And he was so present and just beaming with metta, loving kindness for each person. I mean, it was palpable. So it wasn't like this demented here. I don't know, what am I doing? What should I do? It wasn't like that. It was complete presence. Look in your eyes, complete metta, hand the thing, say a prayer, the next person. You know, and I thought, wow, you know, that's really a purified heart mind. That's to me really the, it's like it so inspires me, that would be, I wouldn't even remember it, but that would be the effect of a life well lived, of a heart and mind that's really purified, you know? So it's not for nothing we're doing this. So thank you for your kind attention, really, thank you, and for your presence. So, yes?
A few closing words.
Someone got their earring? Did someone get their earring that was up here? No? Okay. Yeah, there's just a few minutes, so. Do you?
Is that all right?
Yeah, of course.